Good morning, or depending on your place on Earth, good afternoon or good evening. Ooh, am I choppy? Welcome to Decrypting AI, our weekly live check-in on artificial intelligence and emerging technologies. And we have actually a different emerging technology. Jason's favorite, welcoming here, Jason Nelson, our intrepid emerging technology reporter. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning. How are you doing, sir?
Oh, hanging in, hanging in. But although people do tune in for the AI goodness, this show has always been about also other things that are interesting and exciting to us. And you actually went on a field trip for Decrypt, and I thought we'd start with that. Tell us where you went.
I visited the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, in Pasadena, California last week. They were doing a media day, letting people come see their new Europa Clipper orbiter up close, take pictures, interview scientists and engineers. It was very interesting.
So this was their trip to the moon of Jupiter, nice and icy. And because it is Decrypt, I guess we should get to that headline. What did they tell you about the use of artificial intelligence on this mission?
Well, despite the boom in AI technology over the last year, NASA isn't using AI for this. They're using old-fashioned computers and human computing when the data gets received. I thought that was very interesting. I asked one of the engineers, okay, so what happens? Like, you're not using any form of AI, so what happens if something breaks in on the orbiter or in the orbiter? You're not gonna have anything to fix it to, on the fly. And they're like, well, hopefully nothing breaks.
Well,
That's just.
everything on it has to be on, everything that they use has to be on board, for example. And it's, I would imagine every ounce counts. And they, how long does it take data to come and go between Earth and where this thing is headed?
Well, time frame, like say after everything's said and done and it's already out there and deployed, they say it takes about 45 minutes for the data to get from Europa back to JPL, which I thought was awesome because that's considering how far you're going, that's very fast. I spoke to a few scientists last month, last year, about how data is received from deep space into Earth. And there's a complete array of satellite dishes around the planet that basically receive data constantly from these satellites that are out orbiting the planet, that are out orbiting other systems. And, that's how they're catching this data and they're doing it really fast.
Now, you visited this facility by having to make sure that you weren't carrying any dust with you. Just quickly, how it sounds like you spent a significant portion of this field trip going through that process.
Yes. Well, first you have to, if you scroll up a bit, I have pictures of it. Or scroll down, I mean. There's you have to put on this protective gear that basically covers you from head to toe, covers your feet, and you wear a mask and head. There's a you put on a hairnet, and me wearing a hairnet does seem kind of weird, but anyway, put on the hairnet, and then you put on the covering. And then after you, oh, and then you have to put on latex gloves, which they then tape shut over your sleeves. Then they walk you into this air shower. It's basically a glass room with these tubes coming out of the walls, and it blasts air on you for about 30 seconds. And that knocks whatever dust is still on you off, and then you're clear to go in. What I also thought was interesting is we had to turn over our equipment to a team who then wiped it down and made sure it was all clean. Like I had to have my, like I recorded most of this on my cell phone. So I had to give them that so they could wipe it down with with wipes and things like that. And then, you can take it, then you can take it inside.
Right. Well, we
So
don't
it was a
want
whole process.
Yeah, we don't want a speck of dust from Jason Nelson to throw things off course. I kind of like those clean room protocols. I guess certain data centers are a little picky, but I don't think they're this particular picky.
Not this picky. I've been in data centers before, and they do have a type of outside debris particle type protocol, because you don't want to make the servers dirty or anything like that. But this was pretty extensive. I was really surprised, but it actually, you know, because you didn't have to go through this process, but I figured if when's the next time we're going to be able to get this close to an orbiter, so let's just do it.
All right. So, well, I'm glad you went, and I know that you are a very strong advocate for space exploration or space colonization and other ways that space plays a role in our future. So I'm glad you got to go to this event. My vote is that when it's time for Decrypt to send someone into space, it's going to be you for sure.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I need to be on that one.
All right. Well, let's get to artificial intelligence specifically, not on board the this particular mission, but still taking over the planet. You did the story about AI tokens, which is a great intersection of AI and crypto. So what's happened with all of these different these tokens coming together?
So you had a merger of sorts of three distinct cryptocurrency tokens that are centered on artificial intelligence. You had Fetch AI, you had Singularity Net, and Ocean Protocol. And these three companies focus on artificial intelligence, decentralized AI, things like that. So they agreed earlier this month to form the Super Intelligence Alliance, which is like supposed to be like this dream team of decentralized AI developers. And so yesterday they announced that the community actually went ahead and approved the merger of the three tokens into one token called the ASI, for Artificial Superintelligence Alliance. So that all happened yesterday, and then they laid out how it would work. Basically, the Fetch AI token would be automatically converted to the ASI token, and then the other two tokens would be converted into ASI tokens, or if you already have it on, say, a hard wallet, for example, and it's not on an exchange, then they'll give you the ability to swap those for ASI tokens. What I thought was interesting is that they told people once these tokens turn to ASI tokens on exchanges, don't try to send them to exchanges because you'll lose them and we won't be able to help you get them back.
So are they saying that self-custody is the only way to hold on to these?
Well, they were kind of vague on that part. Like, okay, so what happens if I don't want to send it? Like, does it just go to zero? They didn't really go into that. I think the assumption is most people will, so we don't really have to worry about it. But a question that I did remain unanswered is, well, what happens to the ones that are on someone's paper wallet or somebody's external wallet?
Well, this sounds very complicated. And frankly, I can barely figure out how airdrops work, and I don't have to do anything for those. So rather than going into that, what's the purpose of it? Is it like, we band together? So these are indie, I guess, AI tokens. So they want to go up against the big guys? Well, we briefly lost Mr. Nelson here, but...
So essentially what it is they want to have a way to challenge the Googles, the OpenAIs, the Anthropics, the big players in artificial intelligence, the Microsofts, the NVIDIAs, with a more decentralized, community-facing version of AI development. Because right now you have maybe four or five major players who are developing AI models. This is ideally going to make that pool of developers bigger and also give them the resources to actually, you know, do and create these AI models.
All right. Well, that's very technical. We can get to something a little more accessible. We've written about Avenged Sevenfold before, and they've always had interesting perspectives on artificial intelligence in music. We have a couple of stories on this particular topic, but he's got kind of a cynical view, not necessarily of technology, but of fans. What is he saying, Jason?
Well, I don't know if we want to say cynical, but what he's basically saying is that people won't care eventually if it's AI or not. They just care about, is it good music?
Right.
And that's kind of true. I mean, if you think about it, a lot of the aversion to AI generated music is because it's AI generated music. Has nothing to do with the quality of the song. It has or little to do with the quality of the song. It's just people don't like the idea of a robot creating something that a human can do. A lot of that plays into that aversion. And basically what he's saying is that, you know, that won't matter as these music generators get better. People will just be like you just said, we're not that complex. You know, it's just, we're good. Is it good music? If it's good music, you probably won't even notice. Well, the reason this stood out to me, because it's a lot of the same argument that blockchain developers make when they're talking about creating blockchain games, for example, with, you don't want people to focus on this is blockchain, because then that opens a whole nother can of worms about blockchains, draw on the environment, is blockchain an energy hog, things like that.
Right.
So if I can bury the fact that it's blockchain way down there and you just see this cool game, then I don't have to, I could just focus on developing a cool game for you.
Right. I mean, if it's got a good beat and I can dance to it, I'm into it. Doesn't matter who made it. And just like in the blockchain conversation, if it's in the background, if it's part of the plumbing, then it's really irrelevant. And in fact, I think we're going to run into that issue more and more, because the other side of the AI conversation is you should disclose if you're using it. But if it's built into everything, including our email clients and, you know, every other tool that we use these days, that kind of disclosure is kind of going to become meaningless or, you know, impossible to do, apart from saying, well, fine, AI is everywhere. And if AI writes a really, really good novel someday and nobody tells anybody it's AI, but it is good enough to hit the New York Times bestsellers list, I mean, that's happening in the next year, I'm going to have to guess. Whether or not AI had a role in it does not define whether or not it's something people will like. I don't think you can specifically say programmatically it's good or not good, but people will eat it up. You know, billions of people eat at McDonald's doesn't make it gourmet, but it's popular. And I think that's really the main question when you're dealing with the music industry.
Well, and then going to the back to the Avenged Sevenfold article, you know, he even said he thinks it would be cool if people train their AI on their music. So he's seeing it as a benefit, not as a negative. You know, but it goes back to, or actually it moves into our other story that we're going to talk about with the AI Copyright Disclosure Act that was introduced to Congress by Congressman Adam Schiff, where an AI model has to disclose, our developer has to disclose where they got the data they train their model on before they can release it.
Yeah, we don't have, I have to get that link, but it was probably something that the music industry Hollywood was totally into it. So usually they're like, if the government wants to get involved, that can't possibly be a good thing. But in this case, they're like, hey, we think this is a good idea.
Right. And I made a mistake. We covered that last week. This week we're talking about the vote by members of SAG-AFTRA to they're voting on a resolution between SAG-AFTRA and recording labels to basically say that if you're going to create a digital representation, an AI version of my voice, you have to provide me with separate and clear consent forms before you can do it. And I interviewed the chief negotiator of SAG-AFTRA about it.
Very good.
And it was not saying we don't want you to do it. It's saying that we want you to provide clear documentation separate from the contract for the job.
Right.
Separate from any other disclosures that clearly says this is what we're going to do with your image, your likeness, your voice, and have you sign off on it. And I think that's a big step forward in this whole they're using my image without my permission conversation that had the strike going. What, 6-7 months last year?
Right. I remember that, you know, a lot of the debate was, for example, if you're a background extra or you're not a principal in the cast, the standard contracts would just have like a little paragraph that said, oh, and by the way, we're going to, you know, this image was also could also be used to create a replica of you and we can use it and own it in perpetuity. Like one little sentence and you've signed everything away. So I was intrigued certainly that this agreement that they're now putting up to a vote is so focused on essentially paperwork, but they're basically saying you need to be fully informed. It needs to be its complete, a total and separate thing that you as a actor, or in this case, a voice actor, can fully be aware and make a informed decision whether or not you're going to participate in that. There's a part of me that says, look, you're going to need the work. If you don't sign it, you don't get the work. So there's still a kind of a mismatched power structure, at play, but you're going to at least know that it's happening when it's happening to you.
Well, and I think that's the part of the conversation that still doesn't get discussed enough, is there's still this massive power dynamics, like you just said. Because if you don't want to sign it, we'll go get someone else. Now, right. The idea is because the labels are agreeing to this, they won't do that, is the idea. So you're agreeing with us and our union that you will provide this documentation to our members when they come to you for a job. Now, can we stop you from going to some college and grabbing some kid?
Right.
Probably not. But it protects our members from unauthorized use of their image and likeness.
Yeah. I mean, it's down to the same thing. It's a matter of disclosure, even if it's going to be applied. But, you know, I love that you're on this beat. I love that where you are, you can actually drive down there and visit some people too. So the Hollywood AI beat is definitely a strength for us here at Decrypt, thanks to you. I do want to talk about the Humane AI pin. We'll save that for last. We were talking a little bit about music with Avenged Sevenfold, and now we're talking about this Ideogram AI image generator on the visual side, the image side. Now, Jose is always putting these different models up against each other and, you know, which ones are better and which ones can do text better and stuff. And this is just another upgrade. This is probably what he said was the most likely challenger after the industry leader, which would be like Midjourney or maybe Stable Diffusion. But Ideogram, have you played with any of these? Do you have any personal takes on how Ideogram's upgrade might fare?
I don't. And that's why we have to get Jose in here one of these days.
No kidding.
To go in on that. My view of these different image generators is that they're basically standing on the shoulders of giants. So, you know, you had Midjourney and DALL-E at the forefront of all of this since late 2022. You had Runway out there as well.
Right.
And now you have these new models that are basically perfecting the things that they already did. What I did take away from Jose's article is that how do you pronounce it? Ideogram?
I said ideogram. I could be wrong. Ideogram works for me too.
Ideogram. what I take from his article is that it's very good at understanding what you mean. And what happens to a lot of people is we have an idea in our head, but translating that idea into a prompt that a generative AI model understands isn't as simple as just saying what you want. So what Ideogram does is it takes the prompt and it gives like, okay, so I think this is what Jason means when he says create a picture of a robot bunny sitting in a forest eating a carrot. Okay, so, you know, but if I get more abstract with it, it tries to figure out, you know, what I mean and how to make that picture happen. And the right. quality is really good. I mean, the you know, what it kicks back based on right. these random prompts is surprisingly well, surprisingly good.
So just quickly, you know, he talks about the ability to describe an image. So that's a big plus with the new version. It does negative prompts. You could say, I want it to look like this, but do not include these elements. It's pretty good at that. And I think what a lot of people took away was that these are capabilities that you have to pay for, but it's competitively priced. So in any case, if you want to keep an eye on the latest and greatest in these different tools, video image generators or even music generators like Udio, I think it was Udio, follow us here at Decrypt and keep an eye on what our intrepid technical AI reporter and tester, I think he's going to develop his own benchmark someday. So you can be like on the Jose index. You know, this is a 7.3 on the Jose index, but
so it'll be his version of the Turing test.
Exactly. It has to pass Jose. Did this pass Jose? All right. Well, let's get to the humane AI pin, because this has continued to be in the news cycle, specifically because of the reviews. The humane AI pin announced in November, I guess the embargo lifted across media all last week, and everybody posted their reviews at the same time, and everybody was pretty underwhelmed. I think that the best reviews kind of talked about the promise of this wearable AI pin and what it should do, but then when they get into how it executes it, it doesn't pretty much do any of the things that they said it would do. Any particular takeaways first across all of these reviews, apart from you're glad you didn't spend $700 plus a monthly subscription on this thing?
Well, I've been thinking about this a lot since these reviews started coming out. And you have two things going on. You have a first generation AI tool, the Humane Pen. It just came out. And then you also have the hype around AI. So when you're telling people that you have a tool that does XYZ and it's, you know, this revolution, you can leave you don't need your phone anymore. You can just tap this button. And well, the assumption is that it's going to be like my phone. I tested it today. So I asked ChatGPT, what is the state of Maine, or what is the capital of Maine? And it took about 5-6 seconds for it to come back with an answer. I did the same thing with my phone. I asked Siri, same question, and it came back in 3 seconds. So Marquise Brownlee, for example, who is probably the review that most people are looking at right now, he asked the Humane Pen a question, took about 5-10 seconds for it to respond. And in the age of 3-second responses, that's a lifetime. So a lot of people took these responses as basically down talking the company, like they're creating junk, they're creating all this vaporware. Well, not really. It's just first generation tech. I mean, if we think about the way Bitcoin was in 2009 versus the way Bitcoin is now, it would be considered junk when you compare the two. So Marquise even put out a response to the response he was getting for his review. I think at the same time, you have this whole conversation of, you know, if the public doesn't like something, it's not the public's fault that they don't like it. It has to do with the thing you present it to them. So,
right,
you know, it's not as cut and dry as saying he put out a review and it's going to hurt this company. Well, the company put out something they probably shouldn't have put out yet, and that might hurt the company.
His response view is pretty good. He's like, do reviews kill companies? Like, no, I think they might accelerate if it's a bad product or if it's a good product. But, you know, they alone. I mean, I definitely could see that when people look at movie reviews or something, and now Rotten Tomatoes, when you do meta aggregation, like now you can get a score for how good a movie is and all of that. And, you know, I've actually enjoyed movies that have done very poorly, and I've hated movies that have done very well. So everything is relative. And I think that his point is that he's not the only one. Like, you know, Wired, even the mainstream, Washington Post or New York Times, their reviews weren't exactly great either. I do agree that a cutting edge first generation product is always going to be a rough sell. I mean, we had the same thing with the Apple Vision Pro, right? Is it the next great thing, or is it just going to give you a headache? Like, it could be one or two of those things. But certainly with this device, the execution, probably they weren't ready for the, even though they gave themselves several months before the devices were shipped to reviewers and people could talk about it, everything from the projector to the fact that I remember one of the reviews, he asked the device a question and it basically recited off its own internal constitution. Like, it just completely broke, right? And when you have battery life that's not sustainable, or you have the projector on your hand, but your hand is too small, so you can't read anything it's trying to show you. Like, there's a number of things. It's creative thinking. More power to them. I mean, these are engineers from Apple and other big companies, so I think they're going to be okay. They just have to make it to version 2.
I think, and I think that is the real, I think that's the real thing, is that version 2 of this is probably going to blow us away. But you have to get to version 2, and I think their marketing is what probably hurt them as well. Putting a $700 price tag on this thing and it's not ready to compete with my iPhone, I don't know. It's like, well, what are we doing? So, well, I think go ahead.
Yeah, you can see the way that it would work. And $700 is now competitive when iPhones are $1,200. But if a device, even the reviews were like, half the time you ask it a question, it says, well, why don't you Google this? It's like, wait a minute. That's not helpful. But I agree. Version 2, people are still waiting for that Rabbit R1. And, you know, you have Limitless now with their own pendant, which is, you know, I think it's similarly priced.
I saw another one. It was like a ring you wear.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So we're not quite at the level where we're getting any of these review units. But I definitely think that this is an exciting area because you're doing what makes sense. You're offloading a lot of this processing and thinking that you might ask your phone by tapping or talking to a device that's just ambiently listening and always there. Whether or not that's scary is up for another, is a different question entirely.
Right. Well, I mean, the idea of being able to not have to carry your phone around is appealing, but I don't think this or any of these wearables are at the point where that's actually a viable thing right now.
Yeah, I mean, I love my Apple Watch, but I still got to pull out my phone, probably half as much, but you haven't eliminated the slab of metal and glass in your pocket just yet. Right. Well, we've burned another productive or potentially productive half hour here, and we definitely appreciate those who tune in across the platforms, Twitter, YouTube, and LinkedIn. And we do the show every week, and the registration link is the same now every week as well. So we hope you can join us next Wednesday and every Wednesday here on Decrypting AI. Jason, what do you let them know to close?
All right, everybody. If you'd like to follow this and our other work, you can follow me at Dragon Wolf Tech and Ryan at Hawaii. And then you can read all of our articles on AI, emerging technology, and more at decrypt.co.
All right, sir. All right, everyone. Thanks a lot. We'll see you next week.